Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Colorado rancher, historian, former Duke professor, we have a Duke person on staff, and journalist Dr. Peter Decker is here this evening with his new book, Saving the West. He served as a staff member and policy analyst for U.S. Senator Robert F. Kennedy and was speechwriter during the Kennedy presidential campaign. He served and served as a correspondent for the Associated Press in Vietnam and Laos. As one of Colorado's most distinguished statesmen, Dr. Decker is known for his, well, that's what people say. Maybe you could all tell us otherwise later. For his philanthropy, I love that, and has a long career of service to the state. He was the first chairman of the Board of Trustees of Fort Lewis College. He served on the Colorado Commission of Higher Education under both Governor Romer and Governor Lamb. He was Commissioner of Agriculture and was Director of the Colorado Cattlemen's Agricultural Land Trust. Dr. Decker has also served as director of the National Western Stock Show, which we'll be greeting pretty soon, since 1989. In addition to his books, I love this, he appeared as a penguin in Andy Warhol's It's a Dog's Life. And he is the self-appointed commodore of Ridgway's Yacht Club. Today, he is president of Decker & Associates, an agricultural consulting firm. So let's welcome him and hear more about John Marlowe as he tackles Southern Colorado's issues that are still current these days. So let's welcome him.
Is Didi here? Yeah, there she is. She told me not to screw up because there'd be a lot of friends here and relatives. And it turns out there are. Even part of my medical staff is here. Kevin, thank you. Kevin takes care of my bladder. We won't get into that. I'd like to just some preliminary remarks and read a couple of selections, and then I'd like to open it up to questions. Please, not hard ones, but questions that have to do with the book, and we can go from there. I was reminded not too long ago. I went into the liquor store, which I do frequently in Ridgway before I go sailing, and I ordered a bottle of my favorite rye. And the lady at the liquor store said, "Mr. Decker, we don't have it in stock, but it will be in next week." And I said to her, "I said, well, I spend the summers in Ridgway, and the winters in Denver, and I have to leave tomorrow." She said, "In Denver? Do you do that voluntarily?" And I said, "Oh yes, yes." She said, "That's a place that's a lot of drugs. And do you live in a safe neighborhood?" I said, "Yes, I do." And gangs and murders and a lot of people of color. She didn't use that phrase. She used another phrase. And I said, "Yeah, it's kind of an interesting place to live." But she made it sound as if I had been condemned to a leper colony. And I took that filed it away. I mean, I know the prejudices that country people have of the city. I was leaving God's country to come to Sodom and Gomorrah. And I also know the reverse of that. That is, that spilled my coffee, excuse me, that that country people also make fun and have prejudices and preconceived ideas of city people. I'm reminded of a literary critic, Leslie Fielder, in the 1960s, who grew up on a wheat farm in Montana, and when he moved to New York, he looked back on his experience in Montana and all the people who had left, and he said, "You know, Montana and rural America is like a fished out pond full of bullheads and suckers." And I was reminded again when I taught at Duke, I taught two seminars, urban seminar, city seminar, a history of the city, and an urban seminar, or urban history, which is very seldom taught anywhere. And most of the students were from the city or suburbs, and they had not much trouble with the urban seminar. But when it came to the rural seminar, they kind of scratched their head and said, "Who are these people?" And a member of that seminar is with us tonight, and he nicknamed that seminar Hicks, Hasties, and Shit Kickers. or Dirtbags 101. Isn't that right, Bill? Finally, the last experience I had and story has to do with moving out of Manhattan in 1974. Dee Dee and I hired a mover, a big fellow, Bubba, and he was, I think he was a retired linebacker for the New York Giants. And he was very big and muscular. He came into the apartment, picked up a double bed under one arm, and the dining room table under the other arm, and walked out the door. If it didn't fit, the door jamb expanded. And he threw it in the truck, and we said we'd meet him in Ridgeway, Colorado. And he kind of thought about that. I don't think Bub had ever been west of the Hudson River. And anyway, in 4 days' time, we met Bubba. We told him, we gave him directions to the ranch, and Dee Dee had never seen the ranch before. She saw the ranch and immediately ran for the kitchen looking for the yellow pages and a divorce lawyer. And but Bubba, about the same time, showed up in his 18-wheeler, and it was snowing. 10th of June, 6 inches of snow on the ground. The wind is blowing. The shingles are coming off the roof, and the fence had been blown down. And Bubba could not believe where he was. And he rolled down the window and said, "Sir, are there any snakes around?" And I said, "No, it's perfectly safe here, Bub. It's too high, too cold for them." And about that time, he saw a coyote out in the pasture chasing a rabbit. And the wind picked up again, and the shingles kept blowing off, and the woodshed was leaning out and about to fall down. And Bubba looks at me very, very seriously. He gets out of his cocoon, the warm cab of his Peterbilt, and he's dressed in sneakers, blue jeans, and a T-shirt. And he's got about a 4-day growth on him. And he says, "Sir, I'd like to ask you a personal question." I said, "Yes, Bubba, yeah, go ahead." He's probably going to ask me whether or not I can afford to pay the bill, the moving bill, out of Manhattan to this dirt pile where he has pulled his truck up. And he looks at me real seriously. "Sir, is this a move up?" So I convinced him that I'd work on that answer, and I've been working on that answer for 35 years. In fact, I wrote wrote an essay not too long ago, "Is This a Move Up?" And But it shows, I think, the prejudice and the preconceived ideas that rural people have of urban people and urban people have of rural people. And it's not always true, but it's common enough. And that's one of the themes that runs through this novel. It also runs through another book that I wrote, Old Fences, New Neighbors. And in this book, this is a story of a very rich, arrogant Wall Street investment banker who comes west and buys himself a huge ranch. And he buys it from the Nature Conservancy, essentially. And he, he hires the son of the former owners before it went bankrupt. Nature Conservancy gets it and sells it to this Wall Street investment banker. And that's Mr. Devlin. And John Marlowe is the ranch manager, and he has a bit of a time with Mr. Devlin. Devlin essentially gets what I call hometowned. He becomes very arrogant, and the locals really take care of Devlin. And for example, in one case, Devlin doesn't want anyone on the ranch, no visitors, because if they do, they'll get hurt, and if they get hurt, they will sue him. And they will sue him for all the money he has. So there are no visitors allowed, and he wants, quote, his privacy. Well, there's a group in town called the Circle of Knowledge, and that's the, the Circle of Knowledge. Circle of Knowledge of all the retired guys in town. They go to the hardware store every morning and tell lies to each other and spread wonderful, wonderful rumors. One of the rumors is that on this ranch, on Mr. Devlin's ranch, when Escalante went through there on his way from Santa Fe to Los Angeles, he was led through there by the Ute Indians, and he came across a snowstorm, and he had to lighten his load. So he lightened his load by dropping off a big chest of gold. And somewhere on this ranch is a chest of gold. Believe me, says the Circle of Knowledge. Well, the town goes crazy. They all flood in with backhoes and mining gear to find this, and they dig up the ranch, and place looks like a, you know, after 5 days it looks like a bombed out bombing range, and they have to hire a private security service, and they come in with dogs and bazookas and, you know, a whole bunch of, these guys are very, very serious. I won't get into that, but I would like to read a section here. John is a bit of a wise ass, and he has a number of things on his mind when he is being interviewed by the new owner, and he goes up to his favorite spot on the ranch, and it's called the birthing chamber. He takes Mr. Devlin up there, and Devlin says, "This is exactly where I want to build my house, right here." And John says, "Oh my God, this is where my parents are buried. And this is also the birthing chamber of the elk." So John is trying to figure out how he can discourage Mr. Devlin from building his 10,000 square foot log house. He hears that his
Good. There you go.
He hears that His brother up in Wyoming has on his ranch, and it was just found, the Preble's jumping mouse. And as you may know, some of you may know, that was a threatened species. And John thinks, well, that's pretty good. You know, if I can get those little fellows down to Colorado and put them in the birthing chamber, my boss can't build there. Anyway, they walked across the yard. This is John and his brother towards the kitchen, past the machine shed and shop, and the small calving shed with the squeeze chute and the hot box for the sick calves. Clyde's wife, Irma, her red hair pulled back in a bun, greeted her brother-in-law with a peck on the cheek and offered the brothers a beer. Supper's ready in about an hour. I'm sure you'd be starving, John. You bet, and I'm looking forward to that turkey tomorrow. It's a big fellow, a butterball from Safeway. Sure better than that wild turkey Clyde shot 2 years ago. Yeah, tasted like pinion bark peppered with lead shot. John said, looking at his brother. Well, beats the hell out of the Swedish meatballs I've had at your place 2 years in a row. They must have had a special on them in Silver Valley. You're mistaken. Those were Rocky Mountain oysters in my special sauce. Sure, and calf prices are going to $2. Clyde changed the subject to the home ranch. So those conservationists back in New York found a buyer. What's he like? You've seen the type. City boy, born and bred, banker out of New York, doesn't have a clue about what the cattle business is all about, or ranching for that matter. Bought the place, I think, as a vacation retreat for his family and friends. So he's pretty much left everything up to me except for the big ticket items. At least that's the impression I get. I'll just keep running the place like before, but hopefully without the debt. Good intentions, though. We'll see how long they last when he sees the first winter feed bill and calf prices drop to 80 cents. Sounds like my new boss, Clyde responded. I have a real problem with my boss, and I think you can help, John said. You know the birthing chamber where Dad and Granddad are buried? Well, my new owner, Mr. Devlin, wants to build a new house there, and I haven't told him about the graves, but if I did, he'd demand that they be moved, just like he said the elk could find another place to calve. I've been thinking about those mice of yours, maybe taking some down to Colorado with me and placing them in the birthing chamber. When the Fish and Game boys find the mice, with my help, of course, presto, they'll say, we have a critical habitat. That translates into no permanent structures. What do you think? John, you're one smart son of a bitch. What do these mice look like, John asked. Well, they look just like any other mouse I've seen, but they have a dark stripe down the back in the middle, down the middle of their back, and they do jump. How high? A couple of feet? No, maybe 5 or 6 inches off the grass. So what's the big deal with these jumping mice? Most mice I've seen jump. Doesn't the president have enough to worry about? Wish to hell that sorry son of a bitch would do something about my declining cattle prices and my outrageous health costs. You've heard about the Endangered Species Act? Well, these little furry jumpers are protected by the government, which means if you hurt them or injure their habitat, you're in deep over-your-head shit, Clyde explained. And then continued, the feds explained how the government had to protect the mice to pacify the environmentalists and that there were additional mice on similar creek beds up north and south into parts of Colorado. The good news was I could continue to use the meadow to graze the cattle, but as I said, no new structures. Got any ideas how I could gather up some of these little fellows? The wildlife people told me that they use a small metal live trap, like the ones I use to catch muskrats along the irrigation ditch. Just bait it with some rolled corn and oats with molasses, and they'll jump right in. The bait is the same feed we give to our first calf heifers in the spring. Got some in the barn, come to think of it. That's why I find so damn many mice in my feed bins. You should see the ribeyes on those mice. And my barn cats, which feed on the mice in all winter, they're fatter than an open cow in springtime. Clyde continued, you'll want males and females so that they breed and multiply. The wildlife guys tell me they have 2 or 3 litters a year if properly fed. Any idea how to sex a mouse? John asked. I'm guessing if you lift him up by the tail, you'll find everything you need to know. The testicles will be behind the hind legs, and smaller than Rocky Mountain oysters, but bigger than yours. And Clyde says, you look like you're holding up a dog turd. He said, no, it may have the plague. The plague? Yeah. The plague comes with prairie dogs. Well, these guys hang out with prairie dogs, don't they? And John says, let's go ahead and see if we can't sex these things. Try for once to be helpful, will you? The brothers loaded up 2 traps and a sack of molasses covered grain, and with some additional long neck cores, they headed for Beaver Creek. Clyde stopped his pickup at the exact location where he had last seen the mice. Right here in the meadow and along the bank of the creek, he pointed to John, and then warned, watch your step. We don't want to be destroying critical habitat, do we? Look, right here, Clyde said, excitedly pointing ahead off to his right. Sure enough, in the glare of the pickup lights, they could see 2 pairs of beady eyes looking in their direction. Yeah, I see them, but they're not jumping. I'm sure if you put them on good feed, they'll jump all night, Clyde said. And he moved, to the back of the pickup, unloaded the small traps. Let's get these traps set before they jump way north to Horse Creek. I understand they've got some relatives up that way. John went along with Clyde's suggestion as they baited the traps and placed one in the meadow and the other in the creek bank. Pretty spot in daytime, John asked as he returned to the pickup for a beer. Sure is, that's why the owner wanted to build here. Close to water, nice views to the south, and relatively easy access. Same as the birthing chamber at home, John commented. Yep, and now both places will be home to Mighty Mouse, Clyde exclaimed with a look of supreme satisfaction. I'm violating the law by moving these mice, aren't I? John asked of his brother. Excuse me. Technically speaking, you're probably right, but look at it this way. You'd be violating a small, dumbass law to save the family gravesites. What's more important, the mice or dad, mom, and granddad? You're right. But it will be just my luck that after getting these furry fellows settled and fucking like rabbits, that a pack of coyotes will move in and chow down on them. Not to worry, Clyde assured John. My environmental skills also include coyote eradication and removal. John reached for another beer, pleased with his inventive plan to protect his family's graves. John is is summoned to New York by the ranch accountant, Rigby. He's a very unpleasant fellow. And he is very much for the bottom line. And John has not met a bottom line in his experience at the ranch, either with his parents or with the new owners. So he goes to New York, and he's advised to go into Central Park and see Central Park. And John is sitting there, and he's having this wonderful dream. He has this wonderful dream, and he thinks, what I should do is capture some bears, some coyotes, maybe some prairie dogs, and truck them to New York and place them in Central Park. And then he figures, well, that wouldn't be very, very nice. But that's what New Yorkers want the West to look like the East. Why can't the East look like the West? And John, after sits there and contemplates, he sees the horses and the carriages going by the park and the riders, and he's making snotty comments to the policeman who's riding an old nag, and he said, do you chase muggers and rapists on that thing? And the policeman said, well, we have backup cars to do that. Anyway, after only one day in New York, John found the people to be interested in matters he knew nothing about, or if he did, disagreed with him, like Mrs. Devlin and her conservation ideas, wanting the West to look like the East, or Rigby and his accountant mentality, thinking that everything could and should be measured in dollars and cents. Besides, John asked himself, what could I do in New York? I have no skills to match the city, except maybe as a mounted policeman in Central Park. But he'd be damned if he'd be seen riding on one of those aged nags looking for muggers and rapists. No, he'd just have to be satisfied with the world of Pine Valley back in Colorado and the Diamond J, his ranch. Not a bad life, John had to admit. Something a bit lonely, and the winters often stretched out into May. But the West was changing. No longer the home of independent, self-sufficient workers and owners, it was becoming a region increasingly owned by Easterners and their manservants, wage slaves like John, skilled but no longer the owners. All John really wanted was his own ranch, but given the economics of ranching, he'd have to inherit it, and it was too late for that, or win enough in the lottery to purchase a place, which meant he'd have to start buying lottery tickets. In the meantime, all he asked was an owner who left him alone to do what he did best and who kept Rigby locked up in his urban cage. A pack of joggers interrupted John's thoughts. Why so many of them in New York? Don't they have better things to do than run around wasting their energy and ruining their health as they trotted behind taxicabs? I could put that energy to a useful purpose, or putting shoes on, like, I could put that energy to a useful purpose on the ranch, he thought, like building headgates, cleaning irrigation ditches, or putting shoes on a young colt ready to crack your chest open with a 1,000-pound kick. After that little task, I'd ask them to mount the hurricane deck of a Mustang and ride the buck out of the frightened animal. If they had any energy left over for a jog, I'd send them to town for for some food shopping and a lesson in survival amidst the circle of knowledge. He felt restricted in the city, almost claustrophobic. In every direction, he viewed only the sides of the building or the canyons they created, which prevented him from seeing the sun and certainly not not a horizon, but only infrequently sighted and only infrequently did he sight the sky, the color of galvanized metal with a bitter odor of vehicle exhaust. John turned east on 51st Street. I'm having a hard time seeing here. Is that all right? Okay, good. John turned east on 51st Street and headed towards Rockefeller Center, a site Charles Devlin had suggested. As he walked on, he heard voices over the traffic shouting, "Stop the horse!" John looked up the street and saw a lanky, coal black horse pulling a carriage towards him. The reins were wrapped around a short post at the driver's seat, currently vacant. The horse, outfitted in a fancy black leather harness, highlighted by polished brass fittings, trotted no faster or slower than the yellow taxis and the surrounding yellow taxis that surrounded the rig to the front and rear. A small group of pedestrians on the sidewalk ran along the horse, shouting as taxi drivers worked their horns, and the horse merely moved with the traffic. Clearly oblivious to the clamor and excitement that it had caused, John that it had caused. John quickly stepped off the sidewalk and casually stepped in front of the horse. With his left hand, he caught the reins up close by the bit, and the horse came to an easy stop when John pulled him up by the slack reins. The horse's warm breath felt soothing on John's cold hand. The horse was a big bones, tall, standard-bred gelding, which, as he came to a stop, started to take a leak. He stood calmly under John's firm hand, taking a nibble at his hat, no doubt confused by the identity of his new handler. The sidewalk contingent stared in amazement at John and the ease with which he had captured the horse. John was now talking to the horse as if they were old friends. John expected someone to emerge from the crowd, not to offer a hand that he didn't need or expect, but to claim the horse, or lacking that, maybe possibly some information as to the owner of the horse and the carriage. No, they just silently stared at the horse, its shrieking penis, the puddle of urine, and John dressed in his hat and boots. John asked himself, what in the hell do I do with a horse and carriage in the middle of New York on a busy street with a bunch of irate taxi cab drivers and unhelpful pedestrians? He thought about driving the rig to his destination at Rigby's office, but that would mean doing a U-turn in a one-way street. Or he could go around the block, over to Fifth Avenue, pull up to a fancy store, and tell the doorman, "Hold my horse and carriage while I pick up a diamond bracelet from my wife." No, that wouldn't work either. He'd probably get lost and miss his appointment with Rigby. He thought about perhaps driving the rig to the park, locating a policeman and handing the horse and carriage over to him. He'd probably be given a summons for disrupting traffic with a horse, but that would be a small price to pay in return for an escape from this predicament. John asked an onlooker, "Is there a policeman around?" The well-dressed gentleman remained mute and immediately broke eye contact and walked on. With John holding the horse and carriage near the curb, street traffic had all but stopped as taxis, trucks, and cars moved slowly and cautiously around John and the horses. One taxicab driver adjacent to the horse and carriage, continue to lean on his horn, recognizing the growing nervousness of the horse. John shouted at the driver, "You're not moving the traffic any faster and your horn, with your horn, buddy." The driver leaned out the window and in his best Brooklyn accent yelled at John, "Fuck you and the horse you rode to town on." Nice folks, these New Yorkers, John thought, and replied to the cabbie, "You must be the head of the city's tourist bureau." Another driver from the rear yelled, "Hey, buddy, keep moving west. Kansas City is just over the bridge." Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.